News.
U.S. Foreign Ministry spokesman says the United States uses human rights as a tool in its foreign policy to achieve its goals. Vote counting continues in Lebanon's parliamentary elections as many people hope the results will help resolve the country's economic problems. Also ahead, one person is killed and several others are injured in a shooting at a church in California just a day after a gunman killed 10 people in New York. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour starts here in Iran. The country's foreign ministry spokesman slams the United States' approach towards human rights, saying Washington uses the issue to pursue its own goals. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Washington has degraded the notion of human rights by using it as, quote, a tool in its foreign policy toolbox. He also criticized other major powers for abusing human rights, which he said is one of the most important victims of international relations at the present. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrisas is in Iran for talks on ways to increase bilateral trade with Iran. The Islamic Republic and Cuba are strategic political partners, but their trade partnership has been overshadowed by U.S. sanctions imposed on both nations. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Sharing the same mindset toward the U.S., Iran and Cuba are set to expand their partnership. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrisas made this comment in Tehran at the 18th meeting of the Iran-Cuba Joint Economic Commission.
I would like to reiterate Cuba's resolute will to expand its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran in all areas. We are here to find solutions to illegal measures taken against us by our common enemy.
Iran and Cuba have already had close ties in the health sector. Pastokovac is a COVID vaccine produced jointly by Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. The two sides now hope to build on this successful cooperation and extend it to other fields.
Pastokovac's been one of the major vaccines that are injected to our people today. It's a result of successful joint efforts made by Iranian and Cuban scientists. We're determined to adopt the same synergy in other fields as well.
The 17th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the two countries was held in Havana in December 2016, shortly after the conclusion of the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5+1. Everything was going to change for better, but the reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, following the U.S. pullout from the deal, killed all chances for Iran and Cuba to do business smoothly.
Despite their long-standing ties in scientific and political areas, Tehran and Havana have not done well when it comes to bilateral trade. Last year, Iran's exports to Cuba were almost zero, with its imports standing at a trivial $2,500. Both sides are now poised to give it a jump start, but they need to overcome stringent U.S. sanctions targeting both countries.
Cruel and inhumane was how the two officials described U.S. sanctions. However, both are determined to, quote, neutralize the embargoes using non-dollar channels such as bartering.
Iran and Cuba's common enemies will never succeed in trying to stop our revolutionary development. We will work together with Iran to adopt bartering and other banking mechanisms that will render ineffective and United States' illegal and unilateral economic measures against our nations.
Based on Cabrisa's three-day itinerary, the two sides will sign agreements in the fields of oil and petrochemical industry, mining and nanotechnology, among others. Closer ties with Cuba, among other Latin American countries, come as part of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's new approach toward foreign policy and his attempt to avoid tying the economy to the 2015 deal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, vote counting is underway in Lebanon, where people went to the polling stations to choose a new parliament. Results are expected Monday. The Interior Ministry put the turnout at just over 40%. Nearly 4 million people were eligible to vote. 128 seats are up for grabs. Over 700 candidates competed to enter parliament. The elections come amid an unprecedented economic crisis that began in 2019. The crisis has led to a currency collapse and plunged over 70% of the population into poverty. The Hezbollah resistance movement blames the crisis on a US-led conspiracy against Lebanon. The next parliament is due to vote on key reforms required by the International Monetary Fund to unlock financial support. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters in the occupied West Bank city of El Bira. The protesters were out on the streets to mark the anniversary of the Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe. That's when Israel was created 74 years ago. Soldiers used tear gas and live ammunition to disperse the demonstrators. The protesters waved the Palestinian flags and denounced Israeli crimes. They held placards with signs reiterating their right to return to their ancestral land. The protesters also carried pictures of journalist Shireen Abu Akla, who was fatally shot by Israeli forces on Wednesday. Similar rallies took place in other West Bank cities as well as the besieged Gaza Strip.
On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shireen Abu Akleh was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of culture and people have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
The Nakba anniversary once again reminds the international community of its human and legal duties of defending Palestinians' rights. Iran has reiterated its full solidarity with the Palestinian cause, calling on world governments and organizations to fulfill their obligations and end the Israeli regime's occupation and crimes.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
Now, people have rallied in the U.S. city of New York to mark the anniversary of Nakba, or Day of Catastrophe, and condemn the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh.
Shireen Abu Akleh, we knew her for tens of years, and she was a very good reporter, and she was not biased. She was just reflecting what's happening in the occupied land, and she was mercilessly murdered.
I myself am Jewish, and I feel like it is a very strong and deep duty to criticize the Israeli government and stand up for the oppressed Palestinians that have been living there for hundreds of thousands of years.
Similar protests have also been held in other countries in solidarity with the Palestinians. Protesters in Australia, Austria, Denmark, the UK, and other parts of the world denounced Israeli brutalities against the Palestinians. Turning to Somalia, where former President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud has won the presidency again in a vote by parliamentarians as popular elections remain impossible in the conflict-ridden country. The UN-backed voting took place in a heavily fortified airport hangar in the capital, Mogadishu. Mohamud defeated incumbent President Mohamed Abdullahi in the third and final round of voting. Explosions were also heard near the airport while voting was underway. the election was delayed by more than a year due to squabbling in the government. But it had to be held this month to ensure a $400 million International Monetary Funds program. Somalia has endured a civil war, insurgency, and clan battles with no strong central government for decades. The country is also experiencing one of its severe droughts in decades. There's no end in sight to gun violence in the United States. A shooting at a church in California leaves one dead and five people injured. The Orange County Sheriff's Department says four of those injured are in critical condition. The gunman was detained outside the Geneva Presbyterian Church. The incident comes just a day after a mass shooting at a supermarket in the city of Buffalo, New York. Saturday's attack, which was racially motivated, left 10 people dead and three wounded. 11 of the victims were black. Police say 18-year-old Peyton Gendring, now in custody, was live streaming his carnage. According to media reports, Gendring had written a white supremacist manifesto prior to the shooting. He has been charged with first-degree murder. Earlier, we were joined by Frank Emspach, an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. He says white supremacy is a core belief in the United States and has been part of the country's culture for two centuries now.
Lately, of course, people recognize that there's a shift demographically. And everybody says that, you know, in 10 years or 20 years, white people will be a minority. Well, if for 200 years of the country's existence, more or less, white supremacy was part of the culture, part of the legal business here, it's very, very hard to all of a sudden say, well, that's all gone, in a deep way. Not necessarily people running around saying, well, I'm a white supremacist, but a really sort of core belief in part of the country. And that is what got expression and is expressed by the supremacy theory, by the replacement theory, and hence extraordinarily dangerous in a society like ours, where guns are very, very widely available and people use them.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
New COVID-19 infections are once again on the rise across the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Trump Judge's Anti-Mask Ruling Continues to Imperil Travelers as COVID Rises Across the United States. Here's the story. New COVID-19 infections are once again on the rise across the United States of America, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. COVID deaths in the U.S. have now reached the 1 million mark, a figure widely regarded as an undercount. The steady increase in COVID-19 cases underscores the perilous wrong-headedness of the recent decision by Catherine Kimball Mizell, the federal district court judge in Florida, who struck down the national transportation mask mandate on April 18th. The majority opinion is a result searching in vain for a plausible reason, California Supreme Court Justice Alan Broussard wrote in 1988, dissenting from a poorly reasoned majority decision in People v. Guerrero that broadened the factors a judge could consider when imposing a sentencing enhancement. Broussard's statement also aptly describes the recent decision by Mizell, who likewise reasoned backward by amassing reasons for her preordained result. As of April 17th, the day before Mizell's decision, new COVID infections were averaging over 37,000 cases daily, up 39% from 2 weeks prior, according to a New York Times database. Nevertheless, Mizell's ruling allows individual airlines and transit agencies to decide for themselves whether to require masks. By the end of the day, on April 18th, the country's largest airlines and the Amtrak rail system had shelved their mask mandates. Some pilots announced mid-flights that people could remove their masks, much to the shock of many immunocompromised people and those traveling with unvaccinated young children. The lawsuit in which Mizell ruled was filed in July 2021 against the Biden administration by two individuals and the anti-COVID regulation organization Health Freedom Defend Fund. The two individuals claimed they suffered from anxiety and panic attacks caused by wearing masks. In voiding the mandate, Mizell set forth a bizarre interpretation of authority Congress granted the CDC to promulgate rules to prevent the spread of communicable diseases, writing that the mask mandate exceeds the CDC's statutory authority. In her 59-page ruling, Mizell held that the CDC overreached the bounds of its authority under the Public Health Services Act of 1944 when it imposed the transportation mask mandate. A Trump appointee and former clerk to Clarence Thomas, Mizell was rated not qualified by the American Bar Association before she was confirmed by Republican senators in a November 2020 party-line vote. Her lack of qualification is clear, judging by her misinterpretation of Public Health Services Act. The Act empowers the CDC to make and enforce such regulations as, in its judgment, are necessary to prevent the introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable diseases from foreign countries into states or from one state into any other state. The statute lists examples of this authority, stating that the CDC may provide for such inspection, disinfection, sanitation, pest extermination, destruction of animals or articles found to be so infected, and other measures as in its judgment may be necessary. Requiring masks is a sanitation measure, the Biden administration argued, because it keeps the air cleaner. But Mizell consulted dictionaries and word usage in 1940s to conclude that sanitation requires active cleaning and masks clean nothing. Although Mizell quoted the CDC's finding that masks are one of the most effective strategies available for reducing COVID-19 transmission, she substituted her own construction of the act for the CDC's. Mizell refused to defer to the CDC as required by the Chevron deference doctrine, which requires a court to accept an agency's interpretation of a statute when the statute is ambiguous and the agency's interpretation is reasonable. Instead, Mizell relied on the major questions doctrine, which holds that agencies such as the CDC cannot decide questions of vast economic or political significance unless Congress specifically authorizes it. Right-wing judges often use this flawed doctrine to limit the power of the government to protect people's rights. Mizell concluded that the mask mandate violated the Administrative Procedures Act, APA, which requires granting the public advance notice and the opportunity to comment before an agency promulgates a rule. She rejected the good cause exception to the notice and comment requirement in spite of the COVID emergency. Mizell dismissed as insufficient the CDC's claim that the mask mandate is in the public interest, which is one of the factors included in the APA's definition of good cause. She wrote that the only reason cited by the CDC for the mask mandate is the public health emergency caused by COVID-19. Astoundingly, Mizell noted the court accepts the CDC's policy determination that requiring masks will limit COVID-19 transmission and will thus decrease the serious illnesses and death that COVID-19 occasions. But she then concluded that this doesn't amount to good cause, stressing that the mandate would constrain the public choices and actions. Mizell chose the freedom of travelers like plaintiff Anna Daza, who have anxiety aggravated by wearing a mask over the COVID public health emergency. On April 20th, the CDC issued a statement asking the DOJ to appeal Mizell's ruling. It is CDC's continuing assessment that, at this time, an order requiring masking in the indoor transportation corridor remains necessary for the public health, the agency wrote. CDC continues to recommend that people wear masks in all indoor public transportation settings. When people wear a well-fitting mask or respirator over their nose and mouth in indoor travel or public transportation settings, they protect themselves and those around them, including those who are immunocompromised or not yet vaccine eligible, and help keep travel and public transportation safer for everyone. Accordingly, on April 20th, the DOJ filed a notice of appeal of Mizell's ruling. Inexplicably, the DOJ did not request a temporary pause on Mizell's sweeping decision pending appeal. The conservative U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit will hear the appeal, which could take several months. Ultimately, the case could end up at the Supreme Court. The outcome could have long-lasting significance. A federal district court ruling does not constitute binding precedent, but a court of appeals ruling and, of course, a Supreme Court ruling would. This sets up a clash between public health and a conservative judiciary. And what's riding on it is the future ability of our nation's public health agencies to protect the American public. Lawrence Augustine, a public health law expert at Georgetown University, told the New York Times, adding, "The risk is that you will get a conservative 11th Circuit ruling that will so curtail CDC's powers to fight COVID and future pandemics that it will make all Americans less safe and secure." Gustin also said, "If CDC can't impose an uninstructive requirement to wear a mask to prevent a virus from going state to state, then it literally has no power to do anything." On May 3rd, the day the most recent extension of the mask mandate expired, the CDC issued a new recommendation that all individuals 2 years and older wear masks in indoor areas of public transportation, such as airplanes, trains, etc. The transportation hubs, such as airports, stations, etc. The CDC recommended that people wear masks in crowded or poorly ventilated locations, such as airport jetways. But because one right-wing federal judge issued a nationwide injunction against the transportation mask mandate, the CDC could only recommend wearing masks to protect the American people against COVID, as opposed to requiring it.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Habib Zata, assalamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about an interesting topic. Pets, is it ethical to keep them according to the religion of Islam? Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the pets, yes, there are some animals who are allowed, or, you know, Islam talks about them to keep them as a pet, for example. Cow, goat. You know, sometimes they have said in some of the narrations, obviously, when we look at the Islamic perspective, either we look at the Quran or the narrations, we see that there are certain pets which were, you know, animals which were at the home as a pet. And but the main thing is, you know, when you want to have an animal, you must look after the rights of the animals as well. For example, in the chapter An'am, verse number 38, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَمَا مِنْ دَابَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا طَائِرٍ يُطِيرُ بِجَنَاحَيْهِ إِلَّا أُمَمٌ أَمْثَالَكُمْ. You know, we have the animals and the birds that fly, you know, with the wings. They are not except something like you. They are the communities like you.
Okay.
You know, مَا فَرَّطْنَا فِي الْكِتَابِ مِنْ شَيْءٍ. And we have not neglected anything in the book. ثُمَّ إِلَىٰ رَبِّهِمْ يُحْشَرُونَ. And after that, they all will be gathered towards their Lord. So this verse also tells us that there are the rights of the animals, as we need to look after the rights of the, you know, being a human being of each other. We need to look after their rights as well. And
Islam respects the rights of the animals, okay?
Islam respects the rights of every single, creature. Thing that exists.
Okay, yes.
You know, plants, even, you know, it is said in some of the narrations that cutting off a tree is just like killing a person. So, you know, we have these kinds of narrations as well. So Islam pays attention to every single, you know, thing that exists, because these all are the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah has created all of them.
Yes.
And they all have, you know, their own status. And they are for each other. But on top of that, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made human beings as ashraf al-makhluqat, the superior of all of the others, so these all are made for the mankind so that they can reach to perfection.
Okay. But not living with them, Habib, isn't it?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, just to add off, and then we'll come to your answer. We have, for example, prohibited animals to keep as pets. One of them is dogs.
Yes.
There's a saying that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, told Gabriel the angel, why aren't you coming inside the house? He says, I think that there's a dog in the house.
Oh.
So he goes to the inside the room of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He sees that there's a puppy in the house. So he takes the puppy out.
Okay.
And
also pigs, for example.
Pigs, because they're dirty, yes, and whatnot. But there's no prohibition, you know, keeping one. But you cannot own one.
Yes.
There's a difference between the two, right? And there are different narrations that state, for example, that the Imam alayhi salam had chicken. They had kinds of pigeons. الرواعب, and they curse the killers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And for example, that keep a hen in your house because it wakes you up for Fajr prayers, for example. Yes. Keep your chicken in the house because it keeps away devils and demons from your children, for example. And the Imam alayhi salam had pigeons. I'm 100% about that. Okay. There's a saying that Imam Baqir alayhi salam had them. Yes. And he gifted them to some of his companions and whatnot. Yes. Cows and cattle and stuff like that. Normal for Arabs at the time to have, you know, as pets and, you know, to use and take. We even have this saying that a man, a companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, had a lamb. He raised it until it became big.
Yes.
And then he sacrificed it and ate its meat.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the Imam. He said that before I sacrificed it, it looked me in the eyes and I looked it in the eyes.
Oh.
And I felt some kind of mercy, but yet I still continue to do my work. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told him, I wish that you wouldn't have slaughtered it.
Oh.
And of course, horses, donkeys, yes, and stuff like that were also available.
The goats and the sheep.
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, we see a lot of emphasis on how to act with horses,
mm-hmm,
and camels. Because
yes,
mm-hmm, they usually, these were the mainstream pets. They were usually used the most.
Yes.
And the Imam alayhi salam, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, do not hit your animal. Treat it well. Give it water. Yes. Do not put heavy things on
or
it.
Or cutting out the tails. Yes.
Exactly.
They did not do that.
And for example, he saw a camel that had a lot of stuff on it,
yes,
and its owner was not available. And yes, it was tied.
Yes.
The Prophet said, "Where is this person? This mm-hmm person is going to have problems with me on the day of judgment."
Wow.
So that's something to keep in mind how they used to deal with the animals. Now, something that I want to keep the dear listeners up about is that, for example, keeping pets like snakes and spiders. Because I've seen some people, I've seen python snakes, for example. Okay. I've touched one. I've seen my friends had some, right? I even have some friends who had cobras as pets, right? But at the end of the day, these are dangerous animals to be around.
Mm-hmm.
So the prohibition could be from the dangers that they might bring.
Okay.
So that's something to keep in mind.
So what about living with the animal? Does it have any effect on your lifestyle as a Muslim?
As a Muslim, there's this recommendation. There's this, you know, prohibition of praying in the marabat al-khayl or marabat al-ibn, praying where the camels drink water and where the horses drink water, for example. There's also this. I've seen it before. I'm not sure where. This recommendation of sleeping where the sheep sleep, so sleeping next to the sheep, that's something.
Okay.
Other than that, you know, it's a lifestyle at the end of the day. It doesn't affect you as a Muslim, you know, and as a religion, as your life. Because, you know, because I've been to, you know, a slaughterhouse, I've been with sheep, I've touched sheep. I have videos with sheep as well and pictures as well if you want to see them, brother, I thought, after the show. But the thing is that,
do not live with them, brother. Because nowadays, you know, when we're talking about the pets, it's a member of the family.
There's nowadays, this, you know, bond no relationship, relationship that becomes with it.
Yeah.
I have this story about my grandfather with a dog that he brought. And he had this good connection with it and everything. He bought it from Beirut and he went to, you know, they live in the south, way in the south.
Okay.
My grandparents' village is considered as part of, you know, occupied Palestine right now.
Okay.
So it's like in Google Maps at least.
Okay.
So my grandmother hit him with a rock. He ran away.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of months later, my grandfather goes down to the, you know, same street he buys the dog from, and then he sees the dog over there with the owner.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how close and how loyal he was to his first owner.
Okay.
So there's that loyalty, there's that love that happens between, you know, especially with dogs. Cats are, you know, no, I hate cats.
Okay. But I still believe that the modern lifestyle, Sayyid, considers pets as a member of the family. And this is the problem that I think the religion of Islam has with it, isn't it? Because of the influences of the behaviors of the dogs or cats or any animal on you. And unfortunately, replacing the pets with the child, you know, nowadays we could see so many families getting married, even getting married in the modern world, you know, do not have children, but consider the pet as a child.
So these are the realities, you know. Okay. We see these kind of discussions on the, you know, on the social
how
media.
How belittle is human being?
But the point is that, you know, the main point is that, you know, when you give love to the animals, they will also love you.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, we need to love our kids. We need to love our family. Okay. So the main point is obviously when we do not know why we were, for example, you know, were created.
Yes.
We do not know about our existence, mm-hmm, the goal of existence.
Yes.
Then obviously whatever is in this material world will go after it. And the reason why the people are, you know, changing like or exchanging their children, like not having children but having pets, you know, in a time of their life, they do realize,
mm-hmm,
that what a big mistake they have done. And the pets, obviously, they can have this love with any kind of pet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If they have a pigeon, they have a dog, they have a cat, I don't know, ducks, you know, they can love
usually
them.
Usually the modern world, it's very much impossible to have, especially with the modern lifestyle and the systems, you know, the houses, the type of the houses, these apartments that the people have, you know, for example, to keep an animal in the yard or something like that. Unless you got a big house with a big yard or a garden or something.
These are our own issues, our problems, the human beings.
Yes.
You know, because we have moved to a lifestyle where we do not have enough room. Even, mm-hmm. you know, in Islam, when we look at the Islamic perspective about the house, it says you should have enough rooms.
Mm-hmm.
There should be a separate room for the kids. There should be a place in the house or a room in a house for kids to play.
Mm-hmm.
A yard where you can, you know, go out and have, you know, the sun and the fresh air. So the Islamic lifestyle is different from the Western lifestyle, what we see. So if we have the true Islamic lifestyle, if we follow the Islamic lifestyle, then obviously we need to look after all these things, the issues that are being said in the Islam. And as regards to the pets, yes, it is unfortunately is happening. But obviously, the pets can never be your kids. You know, the pets.
Yes.
For example, a husband and wife who do not have a kid. Tomorrow when they die, who's going to inherit those pets? What are they going to do with the land or the house? Or they need another person to take care of them.
Okay.
They're not just like humans. So this is a wrong concept. This is a wrong concept which has been, you know, injected into the minds of the people. And that's why we see that, fortunately, the Hollywood or, you know, the Disneyland or the cartoons have criticized this thing. You know,
animations
like Boss Baby and all those, how the puppy is going to be. So fortunately, we see that even in this point, those who have the material thoughts, mm-hmm. who are non-Muslims and they do not pay any attention to Islam, they're also with us because they also realize this mass which gonna be, happen. So basically what is happening is it is against the fitrah, it is against the nature of the human beings to replace the kids or human being with something which is, you know, in your control or you're just feeding it. On the other hand, Islam allows it. Why? Because there are many benefits.
I think, you know, respecting the rights of the animals in your idea is very much different from keeping them as the pets inside your house. These are two separate things, isn't it?
These are two separate things.
Separate things, that's right.
Yes.
Okay.
Because
respect the rights of the animals, but it's not necessarily...
You need to give them, as food pets. On time. Obviously, this is a kind of sadaqah for you.
If you have.
For example, in the narrations, brother has also mentioned, in the narrations we have from the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, that whoever has a cock which is... white color and with the big, mm-hmm. you know, wings.
Feathers, yes.
It is beneficial for your, you know, seven neighbors as well.
Mm-hmm.
It, wipes away the bala. So these are in the narrations. As far as it is concerned to the dogs, it is said if it is something like if you have the dog for guarding your house.
Security.
Security. That is fine, but do not bring it inside the house.
Yes.
So Islam gives importance to the animals, to their rights. But on top of that, being a Muslim, we should know the rulings about the keeping the animals first.
Mm-hmm. Also paying for them, for them, and
After that, have a pet in your house.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important because, you know, we just bring a pet in the house. For example, a puppy or a cat. I don't know,
a bird
or anything. Yes. But we never have, you know, learned about the rights of that, you know, animal.
Okay.
So this is important that even if you want to have a puppy in your house, know about the rulings. There is a najasa, there is a purification.
Usually the pets are kept as a hobby, isn't it? And is this hobby making with the animals allowed in Islam? I mean, you being busy with an animal inside the house, normally you have to manage.
Hobby. I know. Me personally, if I had a bigger house, inshallah ta'ala, Allah yirzuqna. May Allah bless us,
all of us.
All of us, inshallah ta'ala. You know, not an apartment house, at least, right?
But a big yard.
A big yard.
Yes.
I would personally bring in pigeons and chicken. And the reason this why... This is good. Not because of the hobby, because of the recommendation available that keeps away the devils.
Okay.
Right? That's one thing.
Okay.
Another thing that some people bring it, not for their own sake, for their kids' sake.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, my Said Mohsen.
Welcome.
Brother Habib, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Okay. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/YN/Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Fruitful Moment with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight. An official briefing in Britain's House of Commons Library dated March of this year and entitled School Building and Capital Funding has confirmed the huge cuts in capital spending since the Tories came to power in 2010. We now present you an article written by Toby Helm. The piece is titled, UK Officials Warn Number 10, England's Crumbling Schools Are a Risk to Life. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Observer. According to internal government documents leaked to The Observer, many school buildings in England are now in such a state of disrepair that they are a risk to life. Emails sent by senior officials working for Education Secretary Nadeem Zahawi to number 10 Downing Street show them raising the alarm on two occasions within the last 6 weeks. The officials call, as a matter of urgency, for the Treasury to make extra billions of pounds available to increase the number of school rebuilding projects, from 50 a year to more than 300. On 30th of March, as part of a weekly update to No. 10 Downing Street from the Department of Education, the senior officials cite the problem of deteriorating school buildings under the heading Upcoming Risks and Opportunities. They say school buildings, the deteriorating condition of the school state continues to be a risk, with condition funding flat for financial year 2022-2023, some sites are risk to life. Too many are costly and energy inefficient repairs rather than rebuilds. And rebuilding demand is three times the supply. The same email goes on to make clear how the Department for Education is battling with the Treasury for £13 billion, now available as a result of recent reforms to higher education, to spend on school repairs. The Department for Education continues to engage Her Majesty's Treasury, the UK Government's Economic and Finance Ministry, to expand the school rebuilding programme by a similar amount as discussed in spending review negotiations. This includes increasing the number of school building programme projects a year from 50 to over 300. On 4th of April, the officials raised the alarm again under the same risks and opportunities heading and repeat the warning that some school sites are a real risk to life. The second email adds, "We would like to increase the scale of school rebuilding." Revelations will pile huge pressure on both No. 10 Downing Street and the Treasury to divert extra billions of pounds to keep schools and pupils safe at a time when they are already facing calls to help millions of people on low income get through the cost of living crisis. On Saturday, 14th of May, Kevin Courtney, Joint General Secretary of the National Education Union, blamed years of Conservative cuts to capital spending on schools and said the current problems range from dangerous roofs to asbestos. Kevin Courtney said all children deserve to learn in high-quality, safe and comfortable buildings. But in 2022-2023, capital funding is £1.9 billion less per year in real terms than it was in the last years of the Labour government. If the government had not cut the Labour school rebuilding programme, £27 billion more would have been spent on school and college buildings. So while any money spent on school buildings is welcome, their scale needs to be judged against what has been cut, which is 50 times larger. Kevin Courtney added, "The challenges that need to be addressed are huge, and whether the issue to be addressed is potentially dangerous roofing, retrofitting for energy efficiency, and to help meet climate obligations or basic repairs. The challenge is made all the greater by the presence of asbestos in so many school buildings. The government needs to show much more ambition and urgently address these issues in a strategic way." An official briefing in the House of Commons Library dated March this year and entitled "School Building and Capital Funding" confirms the huge cuts in capital spending since the Conservatives came to power in 2010. The official briefing says spending generally followed a downward trend between 2009-2010 financial year and the 2013-2014 financial year, and in the years since spending has fluctuated. Overall, between 2009-2010 and 2021-2022, capital spending declined by as much as 25% in cash terms and 29% after adjusting for inflation. In a statement to the House of Commons in July of 2011, the then Education Secretary, Michael Gove, said the design of Labour's Building Schools for the Future programme was not as efficient as it could have been. Michael Gove said it did not prioritize schools in the worst condition and it did not procure new buildings as cheaply as possible. In its place, Michael Gove established the Priority School Building Program, which he said would be available to all schools, academies, community schools and voluntary aided schools, and local authorities that are responsible for the maintenance of a number of schools. He said it would address the problems and be available to schools with the greatest need. But the leaked documents confirm a gradual deterioration over the following 11 years, despite repeated warnings that a crisis was approaching. Bridget Phillipson, MP, the Shadow Education Secretary, said the Conservatives have failed a generation of Britain's children by slashing investment in our schools over their 12 years in power. Bridget Phillipson added, their negligence is now putting lives in danger, but still the Secretary of State can't persuade the Chancellor to act, claiming Labour would build a Britain where children come first. But the Tories are standing by as England's schools are falling down. In 2019, The Guardian reported that more than one in six schools in England still required urgent repairs and cited warnings about schools crumbling around teachers and pupils. According to the official data at the time, 17% of schools were found to have buildings with elements such as roofs, walls or windows in need of immediate action. Of the 21,796 schools for which information was released, 1,313 had elements that were given the worst possible condition, grade D, defined as life expired and or serious risk of imminent failure. A Department for Education spokesperson claimed, "The safety of school pupils and staff is paramount. We have one of the largest and most comprehensive survey programs in Europe, and this allows us to assess and manage risk in our buildings. We prioritize buildings where there is a risk to health and safety and have invested £11.3 billion since 2015 to improve the condition of school buildings and facilities. In addition, our new school rebuilding program will transform the learning environment at 500 schools over the next decade.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.